I'm here with Sethu Vijayakumar and Austin Tate. We're researchers at the School of Informatics, and we're going to talk about an interesting event that they're putting on for the Edinburgh International Film Festival. So do you want to tell us a bit about what the event is going to encompass?
So we were invited to take part in a panel to discuss some of the issues around how artificial intelligence gets used in films, science fiction films. In particular, the film that's going to be shown is Terminator. So we're going to see Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think, acting out as if he's a robot. So the idea is to use it, though, to raise issues about how artificial intelligence is both portrayed in films and what that means for artificial intelligence as it sits today. How far have we come? What can be used? What's realistic in film? What isn't? And look at some of the issues involved there.
I see. So there's going to be a panel discussion afterwards with the audience that saw the film.
We've got a fire outside, which you may hear, or ambulances outside. So yes, the idea is to introduce the film a little bit, get people thinking about perhaps some of the issues just with a little introductory session. Then we're going to watch the film together and then basically go into a panel session where myself, Sethu, and our chairman will take questions, make comments, hear what the audience has to say, and discuss some of the issues together.
Okay, so what is your particular background in AI?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that I'm interested in the AI and the planning side of things, but I'm also fascinated by the actual hardware behind it. So the actual film depicts a humanoid robot, a robot which looks like you and me, making interesting decisions. Some people call it intelligent, others may disagree. Indeed, the whole technology behind getting a system embedded into that form factor, so like a human size, getting everything from the sensors, the planning, the actuation and the motors, and indeed the AI behind it, all of them packaged into something you and me see every day, just people.
Yeah, so obviously Terminator came out quite a while ago, and this is basically what they were expecting the future to look like, and actually the future that they were thinking of would be about now. So can we build Arnold Schwarzenegger in robot form right now?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very interesting question. You think about the history of science fiction and the AI movies and science fiction writers. You've been promising cyborgs and androids and butlers serving you at your home for the past maybe 30, 40 years. And the fact is that we don't have something which does it. And probably we've heavily underestimated some of the challenges. For example, if you want to cross a road without getting run over, all the little subtle things that you have to take into account, people probably underestimated the whole challenge. So playing chess and creating a program which can actually decide which piece to move where is relatively straightforward, but actually getting a robot to reach for that piece and make the move is really hard.
I see. So it's not just the reasoning part of it, but it's also the physics, the movement, and all of that.
Absolutely. So the hardware, the most important, I think, aspect is how people deal with uncertainty and things which are not planned for. So we are very good at it, and in everyday events, we tackle them very well. Programming, unfortunately, is the way it is currently, is not geared towards dealing with uncertainty in a reasonable way. And I think that is our biggest challenge.
So that's to some extent where my interests come in. I've been involved in planning work. I've been involved in making sense of the situation that an AI agent, often is. I work on software agents more than physical artifacts and robots. But basically we're interested in making sense of the situation that we're in with these software agents, and then trying to plan dynamically and adapt dynamically the plans to react to the situation we're in.
And that is still a hard problem.
That's a very hard problem. But you can see that by splitting these different things, and Sethu is a roboticist and he works on the levels of hardware and software. Folks like myself work on other software elements which can be integrated into robots. So if I go back quite a long time to the beginning of my career, and I did my early planning work in the early 1970s, we did actually attach the robotic planning system that we were working on at the time to a real robot. It was an assembly robot called Freddy. It's in the National Museum of Scotland today, and people can go see it. And the plans that we generated out of AI planning systems were intended to cope with some of this uncertainty that I was mentioning. So what it did was deal with parts that were scattered about. It had to find those parts. It had to understand that they were parts of something it was assembling. And it had to put together, in this case, toy cars or toy ships. So it had to kind of understand that things may not be in the same place. It wasn't an industrial pick-and-place robot.
This was all in the 1970s.
This was all done between 1972 and 1975 in that robotic work that I was doing. But that same planning system has been used throughout work, and it's obviously it's grown in its capability, and we're now using it for things like responding to disasters and emergencies, which is what my new most of my research in the last decade has been on. That so that's dealing with very dynamic situations, but the situations are real situations on the ground, but it's using the same techniques that you would use in robot planning. And that's why AI is an interesting subject from that point of view. It has all these different applications which relate to both robotic type vehicles and various agents, but also these software applications in other areas.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that there are certain areas where AI, the current standard of AI, is doing better than other areas, and what would these areas be?
As always with these topics, progress gets made gradually, but also sometimes there's quite a revolution because a new technique comes along. Remember that the scale of what we can do today with computing technologies, the knowledge bases that we have available, because of the web, as an example, you can almost now treat some of the web available knowledge and information as a resource that can be used to improve things like common sense background when you are reasoning about things. In the past, if I go back 20 years, we always used to talk about the knowledge engineering bottleneck.
This was where
you required knowledge to do a task. You needed expert knowledge to do a task. Mm-hmm. And we had techniques that could use knowledge, but then you had the problem of where do you get that knowledge?
How do you encode it?
Right. And who do you interview to encode it? And we were encoding in very manual ways. Nowadays, we can mine that information and extract it in forms off the World Wide Web. And in some of the modern cases of the web, with what's called the semantic web, we're often marking up now and creating that knowledge in its original form in ways that can be directly used in AI. Indeed, we're influenced by the way AI has developed. So, you know, we're storing things in object-subject relationship triples on the web today. It's called the semantic web. And all of that knowledge becomes available for use directly.
And I think I can sort of pick up on Austin's point. I think is so the planning is a key aspect of figuring out what is a good movement or a good sort of decision to make. And indeed, clearly Austin's sort of area is about making plans that are optimal for a particular environment, for a particular goal. But what we've actually found out in some of the robotics work that we've been doing is when we start going into unstructured environments where it is, when you go away from things like, you know, you have pick and place, or you have places where you go beyond a fixed boundary, where you've got uncertainties. There, this notion of what is optimal and what is correct is actually quite fuzzy. This is interesting because the actual subtopic of this festival event is, can robots think rationally? And if you think about it, actually, if you ask the question, can humans think rationally, is a very, very subtle point. There is a very interesting book called... I think it's called Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. And he talks about how everyday decisions that we make may seem optimal from certain perspective and completely suboptimal, sometimes, you know, we won't say, why would you make such a decision? And I think when you start trying to say, oh, we've got robots which have got tremendous computing power, we've got sensors which are really fast and miniaturized and really nice, we've got very good actuation and batteries which will improve over time. So then, is it just the components, or is it the sum of parts really, you know, can we get intelligent machines? And I think the biggest sort of bottleneck is when we do planning and when we do decision making, then the concept of optimality is a very, very ill-defined one in the right sense. You know, what is optimal for me is probably not is not optimal for you. Yeah. And when you, it becomes even more complicated when you do multi-agent systems, when you have to cooperate.
Yeah. So part of that is that people do have these prejudices or perspectives or context, and sometimes taking those on board explicitly means you can explain why you're taking the decision. In a sense, you're acting rationally on the basis of the assumptions you make and the context you're in. Mm-hmm. The problem is that in some cases that can seem irrational to someone who doesn't understand that basis. Yes. You might feel it's rational and a sensible decision, but if it's not explained externally,
and justification given.
Yeah. So this is why, in a sense, you could say, well, why shouldn't a robot or an AI agent perform rationally and be able to explain why it's performing on the basis of the assumptions it makes? What you've then got to think, though, is can those be realistic in terms of performative behaviour on the part of a robot or an AI agent, as opposed to a human, which has a very complex, very capable set of those abilities. So if it's a poor performing, relatively simplistically context-dependent AI system, you might not think it's very intelligent. You might say that it's not a very intelligent system, yeah, you would say. But what it really might still be doing is acting rationally, but on the basis of limited capability.
Yes.
And that's very different to saying it's not acting rationally.
Yes.
So you could say that humans are acting on the basis of many contexts, many assumptions which are not even clear to them,
yes,
some of which are subcognitive. They are actually innate or behaviours which have been built into us because of our background over thousands of years of evolution.
Yeah, I think
that might look less rational than a simply performing, simple system that's relatively dumb.
Isn't there even some neuroscience research that seems to indicate that in many cases we act before we are consciously aware that we've taken a decision?
Mm-hmm. I believe that's true.
So I actually work on such a sort of interesting experiment. So we do this thing called adaptation experiments under force fields. So it's an experiment where you have to reach for a target, mm-hmm, in space, just like you do every day. But now you attach yourself to a little robotic manipulandum which will deflect you on its way. So basically, you're trying to reach for it, and it'll sort of push you to the right or the left. And the idea is that effectively, you're changing the dynamics of your arm. Now, the task is, can you, over time, through repeated trials, learn to compensate for that force? Mm-hmm. A simple example would be if I attached a massive weight on your hand and then asked you to do something like reaching for a target, will you be able to do that very effectively over time? Will you be able to compensate for that dynamics? And the actual pattern of learning that you see there is actually very interesting, because the initial movements you make are suboptimal, mm-hmm, but they are optimal from the perspective of your old dynamics. So if you believed that your system hadn't changed, the movement that you made or the commands that you sent are actually optimal.
So based on, let's say there was no hand pushing you aside beforehand, then you're going to act based on that.
Exactly. So basically, you're initially you do not realize there's a change, and you act optimally based on your current belief about your world, but the world has changed, and so over time you accumulate this error and improve your performance and change it, and the next time the world changes, you become suboptimal again.
I see. Yes.
In the first Terminator film, though, you've got to remember, Arnie, the character that is played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, is a relatively single-minded robot. He's basically there to do one thing, and he seems to take out anything in his path.
Yes.
So in a sense, that raises itself some issues about, out of control directed robots.
Well, yeah, I was going to get onto that. Because a lot of people are kind of a bit scared of robots.
And I think science fiction is a ground where you can think through some of these things in all sciences. And the thread that they're doing at the Edinburgh International Film Festival in 2011, it's called Real Science, real as in R-E-E-L, for the films. So the real science idea is about exploring, through film, some of the ethics and some of the issues involved in the different subject areas. In particular, it's mostly about neurosciences this year, and artificial intelligence is one of those films that's been shown in that series. So this is interesting, because obviously you could just have a debate about these fire and forget kind of robots, you know, a bit like, I think of it as a bit like a UAV. Mm-hmm. The real UAVs that fly today are sent to do missions and potentially are autonomous or partially autonomous. Yeah. There's a big correspondence between a modern UAV and what Arnie is sent to do by Skynet in the Terminator film. And I think that raises many, many interesting issues which are worth thinking through, and we should be thinking those through, and the public should be looking at
that's,
them.
Yeah. That's a good point. Why should we trust AI researchers to build robots that won't go mad? And
you should never trust any researcher. So the point is that these are, obviously, a device could be created which could do harm. A device can be created that can do good. It can be intelligent or not. It can be robotic or not. A hammer can do a lot of harm. A car can do a lot of harm. Yes. A robot could do a lot of harm.
Yeah, but the difference between the hammer and the robot is that there's somebody holding the hammer, whereas if the robot is autonomous, then who is responsible for its action?
Well, precisely. So let me just go back to that UAV anomaly.
Austin, I'd like to take that with Frank, actually. So you said, hammer, somebody holding the hammer. If you actually look at the cars of today, do you really think you have control over your car?
I see what you mean.
So there are lots of things that are automated, and you believe that you push the pedal and the brake works, but there's a lot of automation in between that you're trusting.
And in control systems for things like modern railway systems, you imagine if you believe that a control system will do adaptively something you want, but then it fails, it could kill people. As has happened with aircraft, fly-by-wire aircraft. So the point is that if you believe a system can do something, you may deploy it to do that thing and then it do something else. That's why I made the analogy with UAVs. If you send a UAV believing it will perform in certain ways, which may be designed to be ethically correct and under the control of a human who will take responsibility, what happens then if it performs outside of its operating boundary? Now, take that in a human context. Forget about robots and AI. Let's say that's a pair of people who are in a relationship, an authority relationship to one another, and you ask someone to do a certain thing on your behalf. Mm-hmm. Is it you that's responsible or the individual?
Oh.
It's a bit of both.
Yeah.
And that's why we make individual responsible for their activities, whatever they've been instructed to do.
Yes.
Right? You can't just do something because I tell you to do it, even if you want to.
Yes.
Because you will be held responsible in law for doing that. That's very clear, because you are a separate authorized agent under the control of the law. But if you deploy a machine, it may not be under the control of the law, but it may still be a responsibility of you in law.
Mm-hmm.
What I found interesting just recently was that there has been a discussion of this, they've related it to sci-fi films to some extent. There's a discussion of this in relationship to future unmanned autonomous vehicles, UAVs, and the way they would be deployed in future for surveillance operations and other kinds of military operations and indeed civilian operations. And what would happen if they are deployed and cause things that were not anticipated by their controllers and by their designers? And some of the ethics of that are really key issues.
Yeah.
And what I found interesting in this, and this is a government document, UK government document that was written, openly published, it's on the web, but the point is they're exploring the issues and they're looking at doctrine and procedures for it and understanding there are legal, social and ethical issues. And interestingly, the ethical section talks about it being mostly explored in sci-fi films.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that interesting just because we were getting involved in this panel.
Yeah.
When I saw that, of course, I thought, oh, that's so funny, given that Seth and myself will be on this panel. But if you explore it in these films, at least it's been discussed. It's been brought into the open. People can start to say, well, how do we do something about it? So go back to Asimov's three laws of robotics.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, you know, if you say no system can be deployed outside the laboratory unless ABC, it starts to put in place some controls, some constraints, some design. Now, if someone deploys it outside of that, they could be illegal. That would be unethical for a researcher. It could be illegal for the manufacturer and the operator. So you can see how you can actually genuinely start to make progress here. And what's more, bring things under control and bring things into an area where the public can discuss the ethics and what they're willing and not willing to accept. Get a public debate about that, which is what I feel partly myself and Sethu are doing by being on this panel. Right. It's to raise issues and give our own opinions, but at the same time make people and get people thinking about them so that we're more aware and able to better talk to our policymakers and others in government about what we should do.
Sure. Yeah, because at the moment it seems like deployment of these kinds of UAVs and things like that in the military is not really regulated by anybody other than what the military decides.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very similar sort of paradigm in even things like writing a program. So, for example, you talk about hierarchical control. So you can define hierarchies in trying to execute something on a program. And basically you say you do something, and if that is satisfied, then you do the other one. And then if that is also satisfied, you do the third goal. So effectively, you are structuring the goals of a system by saying that this is priority, then there's a second level of priority, and there's a soft constraint on top of that. And I think this three laws of robotics is a little bit like that, in sort of saying that this is a sort of a human-designed hierarchy for the robots, which are sort of so-called set in stone. But now the moment you make things adaptive and changeable and learning comes into the picture, then there is nothing that says you cannot change anything structurally when you learn. So structural learning involves even changing the hierarchies of control. So, for example, if you think about a nuclear power plant or some sort of control system which controls a fairly, you know, sensitive plant, then you have certain guarantees in place, because you know that if something critical happens, then you shut it down, and then you do the other things only if the top condition is satisfied. Mm-hmm. Now the point is, when you try and strive for either excellence or efficiency through things like learning and adaptation, these structures of hierarchy themselves need changing or adaptation. And if you allow a system to do that, there is no guarantee that you can go back and say, hey, I built in this guarantee that it should have shut down if, you know, there's a likelihood of a nuclear core meltdown. Forget the efficiency bit.
Because, of course, in terms of the Arnie character again,
yes,
he was sent to do a job.
Yes.
And he was authorized to do that job, and he was built to do that job.
Yes.
And he was trying his best to do it.
Yes.
So you've got to appreciate that at the end of the day, control and who deploys these systems and the authority that they have or the madness that they have is all key.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so getting back to the event that you're doing. So why do you think people will come and watch a movie that was made several decades ago?
Well, I think we've just been having this debate with Austin, and thinking, you know, somebody pays a price to go in and see something that you can pull up on the web and see freely. So obviously people are strongly interested in some aspects of the film. Either they're a big fan of Arnie, or they have some very strong views on some of the philosophy that this picture depicts. So either they are fascinated by the future of what such a system could do, how our society would change and react to such things when capability arrives. And I mean, if you look at what Bill Gates talks about, you know, the parallels between robotics and AI and then the computers of 20 years ago, basically there's an interesting thought that robotics and AI are at the same stage where computers were 20 years ago. In other words, now we have little computing devices in our pockets. So we could think about a future where you have not necessarily all autonomous robots, but even bits and pieces that people use. So for example, if I had a stroke or if I had an injury, say playing football, or if I have some sort of genetic defect that prevents me from functioning in a normal way, you can potentially use these robotic systems to do better, essentially an assisted living sort of application. And in those scenarios, it's fascinating to think about how the society would move and react, just like we do in the social networking system now. How would the society actually react to something like that? And I think people, at least my hope and my feeling is that that's what people are coming to debate. And in addition to all this ethics thing that Austin talked about.
They've got to be interested in the topic for some reason, either because the sci-fi relationship to AI is of interest to them in what might happen in the future, or because they see some ethical issues or some control issues, they want to debate it. I don't see people just coming to see the film itself. We did early on talk, before the film was chosen, that we did talk about alternative possible films for the event, and so quite a few of the ones that we were looking at had a much more a very different style of robotics or AI in them. Remember that AI can be disembodied. It doesn't need to necessarily look like an android or a cyborg. So the Skynet, for instance, is itself meant to be an AI thing in the Terminator series. But there's other films. If you take the Spielberg AI film, for instance, we're talking there about more companion-style robots. The childlike robot. The one I like in the Spielberg film, which I think is an interesting character, is the teddy bear robot. Yes. It's called Teddy. And it's meant to be an elderly uncle style of character that's very wise, knowledgeable, but acting as a support to the child. And it's meant to grow through the child's life and be embodied in different devices. But it is an AI that's long-lived and embodies the kind uncle style of helping a person through their life, but then adapting as they get to middle age, when it may be not embodied in a teddy bear but in a cell phone, and then later in life where it may be some sort of companion style robot. And several of us here have worked on companion style robots for the elderly and for the infirm, or for the people who are coming to the end of their life and need help to stay in their home rather than having to be taken into a care home. And in some cases, some of these robotic devices are real today. There are medical robots and companion robots which are either in the laboratory or partially deployed in experimental ways. And these companion robots have a very different style. They have an embodied, they do move about, they can do, but they're there as AI reminder systems and AI support systems for the individuals involved. Now, you can imagine the debate could be very different to the killer robot style of thing if we had that sort of system.
I mean, and also I think there are examples of such robots being deployed in the society now. For example, there's a robot called Paro in Japan, which are companion robots for elderly people. And there's another there's a robot toy doll which is being used as something to improve communication among autistic children. So there, the form factor and the reaction to what somebody says, the recognition and the reaction is very, very important.
So what I'm curious about is, you use terms like companion robots. Do people actually treat these robots as if they were real people, or do they still treat them as machines?
So it's funny you ask this question. So about a couple of years ago, I got a call from a press agent, and they asked me, can you comment on an interesting new PhD thesis that came out of Netherlands? And this was about somebody sort of predicting that we would be marrying robots in, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years' time.
Oh, I think I've read the book.
Yes. So, I mean, I personally think that And I think the
very personalist.
Yeah. So, there are a few other instances that came to my mind just now. So last week there was a report on CNN, which, or maybe it was just 2-3 days ago, that somebody legally married a doll in the US. Okay. And then there was another a very close colleague of mine who's a robotics researcher in Japan, actually got married to his wife, and the ceremony was conducted by a robot. It is called the Kokoro robot, and this was he's a very close collaborator of mine. So it isn't beyond the realms of thought that one would. Already in many ways people started thinking of robots as real living things. So my 6-year-old daughter has grown up seeing robots, and I think I can trace the way she's actually evolved and looked at robots right from when she was a 2-year-old, when she looked at a television ad where somebody was driving a scooter with a helmet on and said robot. And she had generalized her concept of a robot to somebody who wears a helmet like
me. So I don't think you need to think of it as a human relationship. Yes. A companion doesn't necessarily mean human. I mean, the teddy bear model I was mentioning is a good instance of that. People don't think it's a real teddy bear, a real bear.
Yes.
And they think of it as an embodied thing. It's a toy to some extent. But if it behaves such that it remembers what you're doing, it knows what you're doing, it can speak back to you, it has recall, it has understanding, it has feedback. Mm-hmm. It starts to have a relationship to you that you can understand. Now, you may not have a word for this, we may not have a terminology for it today, but the idea, companion's a good word for that purpose. It doesn't mean human.
Yes.
Companion. There's a lot of instances of this. We, for instance, I have a Sony Aibo at home, which is an Aibo robotic dog, and it's a bit of fun. We show it to visitors and guests, and mm-hmm. we bring it to work and show people. But the point is, it's adapted to you as an individual. It knows three people. It recognizes those three people visually and by voice. It does react when you come into the room and sees it's one of those three differently to others. So the reaction itself is a very simple example of feedback, which means you know it's seen you.
And I think there's an important aspect that it doesn't react same every time.
No,
there's
I know.
A level of stochasticity.
It's a very complex set of behaviours. The Sony Aibo is the most sophisticated of the commercially available robotic companion style things. It's not manufactured anymore, but they are around. These were used in research, but also used as companion style robots and sold that way. Now, interestingly, my wife's a teacher at the Royal Blind School, and she's blind, so they can't even see the dog and its reactions and its movement and so on, but they can hear it. What's more, it's very touch sensitive. It has a lot of touch sensors on it, and it gives gentle feedback, like pushing back on people when you touch it and stroke it. And because it does recognise certain people, it can have certain reactions which they come to recognise as to do with them. The kids love that robot going back in. My wife was just saying she spoke to someone who left 3 years ago, and when she met that child, the first thing they asked was, "How's the Sony Aibo dog?" Okay. So there's an interesting kind of relationship there. Now, the point is that robot is connected to the internet. It has a Wi-Fi connection. It takes pictures. It looks for its favourite thing. It takes a favourite image each day. It makes a blog entry each day. It has all sorts of things. It can also act as a relay for your instant messaging and your email. Uh-huh. Now, all of a sudden, this thing is acting in some sort of capacity to do partially useful and fun things. Now, if that device was 50 times or 100 times more capable and stayed with you through your life and came to understand what you needed and when you needed to be reminded of appointments or drugs you should take in old age, then it started to challenge you and ask you questions and ask you if you wanted to be put in touch with your daughter via Skype because you hadn't spoken to anyone the last day or two. You were a little bit more isolated. Or it looked at the temperature in the room and realised you were going to be too cold tonight as you get more elderly and said, "Would you like me to put the heating on?" Or as you went blind, it reminded you of the time, like it being becoming a speaking clock. Mm-hmm. One of my elderly relatives was in a care home once and gone completely blind, and we were visiting her, and the speaking clock she had on the thing started giving the time, and I could see she reacted to the fact it was speaking. Yeah, it was just a speaking clock.
Right.
Now you imagine if that was part of your companion aid. This means this relationship issue, which I don't trivialise to mean human relationship, could be a very interesting thing, and indeed an interesting social thing to look at over the years as we do get much more capable devices that do live with us, and some of them will be delivered through traditional technology like you're holding today, and that we might have in our cell phones for most of us in normal middle age. But it could be very different for kids and different for elderly, which is why a lot of people are interested in robotics at those two extremes. Because there's lots of things you could potentially do without having to solve many of the physical problems of very ambulatory robots. One of the companion robotics projects we worked on, the robot itself was relatively simple. It could move about, but relatively simply. But it used a sensor network and an actuation network of aids within the home. So it actually knew where you were. It didn't follow you around. It could follow you in the sense of being a Skynet, in this case a benevolent Skynet, one would hope, but more like a home network.
Yeah.
And the idea would be that the package would have been sold with a small ambulatory robot, but a number of sensors and actuators to assist you in living within your home as you got elderly or perhaps had early phases of diseases like Alzheimer's.
Okay, I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. So another maybe final topic that I wanted to touch on is what with the funding cuts and everything, do you fear for the future of AI in terms of there's not going to be enough funding so we can't make the progress that we would like to?
Yeah, so I think AI has become so broad that I think it's fairly... It's like saying, do you use computers in a particular subject or not? Now, it's probably it doesn't really make sense to say that teaching programming or computer science per se is a subject in itself, because computers are so ubiquitous and they are used in every field. And I think AI has a similar thing, is that whether you know it or not, the AI, when the moment you sort of collect data, process it, make sense of it, and do something with it, there is some element of AI in there. Your washing machine, your dishwasher, is to some extent intelligent.
It's got a fuzzy controller.
Yes, it's got a fuzzy controller. Yes. So I think the funding cuts are certainly affecting all the areas, in ICT there's I think people realize that ICT is quite crucial in various areas for the
food. Sorry, ICT.
Information and communication technologies. Yes.
Which is what they call it at school level.
Yes. So the sort of whole computing sciences, informatics, robotics, AI, all of them come under the sort of ICT umbrella.
Okay.
And I think people realize that one cannot afford to make significant cuts. There are problems, and there's a general level of less money around sort of scenario. But I think people realize that you cannot afford to have significant cuts in the ICT area because it is so ubiquitous, and progress in many fields depend very strongly on it. So there is generally a crunch in terms of funding, but ICT is less affected, I would say. There are now more focused sort of funding scenarios where people are looking at where would the future of society go. So if you look at large-scale data processing, intelligent data processing, intelligent manufacturing, intelligent assisted living. So all these areas are where the need is. And the idea would be now work backwards. What are the fundamental scientific endeavors that are driving these technologies, and then using and figuring out how to fund those key primary areas so that when you're ready to say create a smart home, which requires sensor networks and maybe intelligent AI and robots helping you, you have the infrastructure and the basic science in place to actually do it.
I would say there's clearly a short-term problem, just because we have the economy is not good across the whole world. So, of course, that will affect short-term opportunities for research projects and for funding PhD students and other things that are very relevant to these areas. But I've been around long enough to have seen already two winters of funding in my own subject area of artificial intelligence, true of many other areas, separate to economic declines and rises and sector-specific rises and declines. So I don't think this is a long-term issue. I see AI, what it could do, as a very long-term thing. We're basically barely scratching the surface, I think, of what will be able to be research opportunities over the coming decades and centuries with this sort of technology. It's like saying, will you be studying human sociology? Will you be studying, the nature of thought? These things will be there as long-term opportunities. And although we've made good progress, we're really at the start of a long-term subject that will have broad impact alongside many other technologies.
And I should say that we're probably in a very exciting period, because the progress at the level of computing, at the level of materials, at the level of sensors, at the level of actuators, are now at a stage where maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people had very good ideas, but it took forever to compute with something or, realize something. And then you said, yeah, sure, that looks like an interesting idea, but it'll take me 5 years to try it out, so let me move on to something that I can do right now. So I think we are at this stage where these new ideas can be implemented and tested out and tried very, very effectively and quickly. And so that makes it a time when I think we can really have very fast test cycles of these concepts.
And I would just add to that the availability of the World Wide Web and the social networking elements and the community sharing knowledge elements and group elements of the web is going to be a force for this. I mean, there is already a lot of AI and semantic web technology in that area. But it does give you the opportunity to create communities which do share knowledge, which do create, author, and curate knowledge, and make it available in broader ways than ever could be done before through devices which are mobile devices. And I think that itself is going to be a driver for the different kinds of AI. Now, going back to the Terminator films, of course, that could lead to a Skynet, so we're all going to have to be very, very careful with that.
Absolutely. So
watch out for Skynet, I would say. or today's surrogates for Skynet.
Well, you never know, but the Frank could be actually an agent, Skynet,
Yes, it could be a
time. Let's just take his arm off here. Oh, why has he got dark glasses on, and what's that red eye behind there?
I think it's time to stop this interview now. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.